This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the founder and CEO of Synergy Aircraft, which is attempting to create a roomy, fuel-efficient airplane using advanced aeronautical and manufacturing technologies. In the news, we look at damaged airliner noses, new security measures at airports worldwide, the credibility of United top management, and the A330neo. The conversation gets a little animated when we talk about the positive airline story of the week. Listen and tell us what you think. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 476 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Welcome, folks.
That's right. As we record this, tomorrow is Halloween, isn't it? I didn't even think of that. We should all be in costume or something, maybe.
Oh, is it really? I didn't even realize that.
Trick or treat time. Speaking of treats, also joining us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian who sometimes blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Yeah, I need to get back to that.
Yes, you do.
And I need to apologize to our listeners. It was pointed out that there's been a lot of pops and pings and beeps and notifications on my recording, and I finally figured out how to unplug the laptop from the phone. Evidently, Apple has decided that all of the devices need to speak to each other and report multiple times. So hopefully tonight we will not have the problems that were reported to us, and I appreciate the feedback.
All right. Also with us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. Really glad to be here, except I got a new toy, and I'm really looking forward to playing with my new toy. I got a 3D printer.
Ooh, cool.
And it just showed up about, I don't know, half hour before we started to record. So I feel like a kid at Christmas time and just can't wait to dive into the box and open it up.
Maybe you can make like little special Airplane Geeks trinkets or something. We'll have to think about that.
Ooh, there's an idea. Or just print an airplane. That's what I'd really like to do.
Yeah, and maybe you can send it along to Max Trescott so he can get to his home a little quicker. He's stuck in traffic, we understand, and so Max Trescott should be joining us, well, hopefully pretty soon. But we're going to go ahead and launch. Our guest this episode is John McInnes. He's founder and CEO of Synergy Aircraft. Now, they're a seed stage company that's developing a quiet, roomy, fuel-efficient aircraft. They're using advanced aeronautical and manufacturing technologies. Now, John is also the founder of MC Squared Design USA. That's a service bureau that provides 3D design, CNC machining, 3D printing, and composite fabrication. And also MV Aero, which is a provider of state-of-the-art computational fluid dynamics simulation, CFD. Now, John's a senior member of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and he's an EAA contributor. Now, historically, he logged a few hundred hours in a dozen types back in his student pilot days. I'm not sure how long ago that was, but I don't think it was real recent. But he set that aside to raise a family. Now, he's personally designed and constructed this Synergy airplane. That's a way for him to get back in the game, I guess, or at least maybe that's how it started. It even led to the best inventions of 2013 in popular science. John, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, thank you, Max.
Now, I see that you want Synergy Aircraft to become the Tesla of the skies. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's got a path that's just like what we saw with Tesla. They wanted to make a case for something that didn't seem to be what everyone thought which was maybe electric cars would be cool and practical if you had the right priorities. And so, you know, they started off with a adapted vehicle and then turned it into something that was good for people, you know, that wanted to tinker with something and mess with a really hot, neat hot rod. But before you could really do anything for the masses who might adopt it, you'd have to raise $25 billion or something, you know, like that. Actually, more like $12 billion, but 25 times to get to the point where now people are actually betting on Model 3 and seeing electric cars as practical.
Hello.
That must be Mr. Trescott.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thanks for waiting for me.
We didn't wait for you. We started, actually. So.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes.
Well, see you guys next week, then.
No. So, yeah, we want to welcome the tardy Max Trescott. Well, no, we don't want to paint that picture, but this is a problem with HOV lanes, isn't it, Max?
Now, this is a problem with car accidents and not being able to drive in the HOV lane when your car's in the body shop.
Yeah,
I had an accident a couple weeks ago, and I'm greatly awaiting the return of my car. In the meantime, I'm stuck in the slow lanes.
All right. Well, again, Max is host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert, and we are glad that you finally made it.
Happy to be here.
All right, before we get into the news, just want to mention that, you know, lately we've covered several new aircraft designs being developed by startups. In episode 473, we talked about the Equator Aircraft P2 Excursion. That's the hybrid amphibious aircraft. In episode 472, we talked about the Martin Aircraft Jetpack. And here we are again in another episode talking with John about the Synergy aircraft, another new design being developed. And part of our intent here is to, well, not to necessarily promote these particular aircraft, but to kind of talk about the process of bringing a new idea to market, a new aircraft of various types. And so we're going to continue that this episode. John's going to, I think, give us some insight into not only what he's done specifically, but also generally with the process of starting with an idea and trying to create a new aircraft. But first, we're going to jump into the aviation news from the past week. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from 9news.com.au. This came in from Mick. Mystery surrounds plane's squashed nose. What we have here is a Boeing 757-200 that was on a flight that, well, the passengers heard a bang, and when the plane landed, they all saw that the nose was kind of crushed in. Delta said Delta Flight 8935, operating from Minneapolis to Chicago Midway, is a charter flight for the Oklahoma City Thunder. That's a basketball team. Likely encountered a bird while on descent into Chicago. The aircraft, a Boeing 757-200, landed safely without incident. Customers have since deplaned and maintenance teams are evaluating. Safety is Delta's top priority. We have some photos that have been published of the nose of this aircraft, and this is no small little dent. What do you think, Rob? This looks like a significant strike.
Yeah, it kind of does. And I guess what I find a little strange about this is that you didn't hear the crew saying, well, we think we hit a bird. The story quotes some of the folks in the back saying, I think we hit a bird.
Mm.
But it should be pretty easy to figure out, because you're going to have guts and feathers and blood and all kinds of things all over the nose. But
you mean all that stuff that shows up in these drone strikes on a regular basis?
Right. Those things. And they, what do they call that stuff? Schmurs or something like that. The ornithologists have a word for that. But anyway, but there's nothing in that picture that looks like anything remotely associated with anything that was living. So then the question is, what the Sam Hill did they hit?
We heard from Grant McCarron.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said, don't forget that third-party radome that collapsed due to being under spec and collapsing due to air pressure. Could it be the same thing?
I think so. the photos of recent aircraft that have been damaged, they all look remarkably the same. Are these planes all hitting the same bird or the same drone? I'm more inclined to think that, there's a component that's failing in a similar fashion.
It does make one wonder. We kind of poked around, and we see that in 2015, there was a Turkish Airlines 737 that was hit in the nose by some kind of a bird, I guess. And when you look at the photo of that, like you're saying, Rob, there you can see some red smudges, and I think the evidence that what hit it was a bird. But the scope of the crushed nose looks very similar to this more recent situation.
I
got to
tell you guys that this whole thing is pretty impressive to me from a composite standpoint, because in both of those cases, the whole front radome has collapsed inward, but it's not really buckled in the way that one would expect. It almost kind of looks like someone took a metal radome and beat on it with a giant hammer or something, the way it collapsed inward. And that's actually good design when that happens. One of the problems with a radome is that you're limited in the materials you can use because it has to be radar transparent, and it's getting a lot of radiation. And normally that means that whatever you build is likely to shatter when something hits it. So there is some breakage on the bird strike pictures that we've seen, but this particular flight doesn't show that same type of impact damage. It's really curious.
It is, and I think you're right. And there is a photo of a bird strike. This was against a Singapore Airlines 777, also in 2015, as it turns out. And in that case, you do see that sort of the cracking. It doesn't have the same appearance as these other examples where, like you say, the nose looks pushed in. But in this case, you do see some cracking, and it looks like a piece of it missing. But there's also, if you look, there was a situation in 2013 with an Air China flight. The images from that looked remarkably like the recent Delta experience, and that was deemed to be a bird collision. These things do happen. Of course, David, there is an organization that we know about that is kind of skilled when it comes to performing that analysis to identify, was it a bird? And if so, what was the species?
You mean the Smithsonian Institution Natural History Museum? The Feather Identification Lab. And we've had them on several times on Be a Pilot Day, where they do analysis, and they have a very large database of reports that they've been filing over the years. So it would be interesting to see if there's any similarities in their database of a strike like this.
Sounds like what we get up here. We figure out what kind of roadkill did your bumper in. Well, I've got a friend. He sells aftermarket bumpers for trucks and things like that.
Okay.
It's just a huge business, because every other truck has some sort of critter mass abatement device on it, right, to keep everyone inside from getting killed. In fact, I think it's kind of astonishing that we see this so rarely in aviation. It reminded me of the time when I had a kind of a transformative thought. We had done a big, long cross-country. We were coming back from Oshkosh. And for some reason, my family and I had scheduled it so that when I landed in Kalispell, I'd get out of my John Paul Noyes' RV6, and then I'd drive to Wenatchee with my family. And I tell you, the truth was, I hadn't gotten behind the wheel of that car for more than 10 minutes before my heart was racing, and I was really, really stressed out, and I couldn't figure out why it was. And I think it has to do with the fact that there's so many threats on the ground. You know, when you're flying, a lot of that will shut down, especially after a long flight. And then all of a sudden, you have to visually process a car in this lane, a car in that lane, oncoming traffic, dog running in front of you. And, of course, out here, it's deer and elk on the highway. We slalom around them all the time out there.
Oh, dear. Oh, yeah. It's interesting how it's a different mental kind of exercise in some ways.
Yeah, it's nice. There's not as much to hit up there, that's for sure.
All right, well, hopefully Delta will take a look at this. And, again, kind of to your point, Rob, I don't see any smearing or evidence of a bird in the photos, but presumably they'll take a good close look at this. If it's not a bird or something with blood and guts and bones, I'm not sure what it might be, though.
And it wasn't raining, right? So it couldn't have gotten washed off.
That's a good thought. Yeah, no, I don't think so. But I think it was at night. I think it was dark. And so some have said, how could it be a bird? That'd be, you know, if it was at night.
That's silly. I've had a bird strike at night. They do fly at night, folks.
And Brian, there will be stuff inside those cracks, not just mm-hmm. the outside, to not be washed away.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, next item comes from Bloomberg. If you want to fly to America, get ready to be interrogated. There's also an item in Newsweek, what you need to know about new airport security rules. So what we see here in March, if you'll recall, the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, had banned personal electronic devices larger than phones on direct flights to the U.S. from 10 different airports, popularly called the laptop ban. So now that's been loosened, but there are some additional security measures in place where passengers to the U.S. will be asked some additional screening questions. And according to these reports, that affects 235,000 passengers on 2,000 flights daily to the U.S. on 180 airlines from 280 airports in 105 countries. So this is a lot broader than just the 10-country PED ban that we saw previously. And as you might expect, the airports and the airlines, many of them are saying that this is going to cause some delays, and so you'll need to get to the airport earlier than you might have in the past. But when you look at these questions, and you know, did you? I mean, they sound like the kinds of questions we already get asked in the U.S. And I guess I'm kind of surprised that that kind of interrogation wasn't going on around the world already.
But you know, if you were planning an act of terror, don't you think you could read the questions ahead of time and come up with really good answers? it does seem like this is kind of like our bad passenger stories. There's one a week. It seems like we're getting a new security rule just about every few weeks. And I almost wonder, you know, are they offering employee bonuses for DHS people that come up with new ideas? I mean, it just seems like we're constantly getting a change. Maybe they promote people every time they get a new idea, so that's why we get all these crazy new rules.
Hey, Max T, how about this for an idea? Instead of coming up with new security procedures that, again, quite honestly, don't make me feel any safer, how about if our government stops doing stupid stuff that makes the rest of the world hate us and want to kill us? And if we solve that problem, we can get back to normal security at airports and not have to deal with this crap?
You mean take the target off our back?
Yeah, not to get too political, but yeah, no, that's a root cause, solution kind of approach to it. But, you know, if you couple behavioral analysis with this question asking kind of process, then maybe that makes sense to me as being more effective. But I suspect that we haven't trained hundreds, if not thousands, of security personnel across the world to employ behavioral techniques the way that's carried out in some places. So, yeah, I kind of wonder about the effectiveness of this.
Yeah, but, you know, this is not new. I mean, when I traveled in Europe 40 years ago the first time, I mean, and I went through places where the Israeli security force, even in Germany, even in West Germany, as it was known then, you'd go through security and there would be guys there in uniforms with automatic weapons, and they would take people out one by one and take them into a little cubby hole, pull the curtain and talk to you and examine you and go through your stuff. And I mean, that was a long time ago. And somehow it's just so weird that we're talking about this like, what a concept. Or should we be profiling people? And I don't mean based on their race or gender or anything else, but behaviorally. I mean, the Israelis have been doing this for decades, and we're acting again as if it is something brand new.
And oddly, I think it was Inspector General of DHS, or maybe TSA, who said that the behavioral analysis was not working and that they were spending too much money on it. So you get different kind of views as to how effective that is.
Of course, we don't know how those people were trained for, you know, in terms of the behavioral analysis. I mean, they just say it didn't work. Well, it's not always that simple.
Right.
Well, let's move on. We've been kind of kind to United Airlines for quite a number of episodes here, I think. But there's an article in the Chicago Tribune. It's a column titled, "Can United Airlines Brain Trust Survive Another Tough Journey?"
Brian, I didn't know you're writing for the Chicago Tribune now.
So, and this article has nothing to do with me. I did not submit this one.
Oh, okay.
Well, Rob, you're in Chicago. Tell us what this is about.
I saw this in the paper the other day, and I just had to add it to the list because I, despite the good, bad, or otherwise that people talk about when it comes to airlines, United does seem to continually fall on its face. And it's not simply the publicity issue that we're talking about. We actually never have, although that's what it might sound like. But this past week, the financial analysts were taking United and their C-suite folks to task for making it very unclear about the future of the airline in terms of what their plan was to get it to make some money. And they had a very bad financial call week before last, I guess. And the analyst said, "So, Mr. Munoz, what's your plan to get United headed in the right direction?" And I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, "Well, we don't have the answer yet. We're still kind of working on that." And I guess the analysts didn't think that was such a great answer. And when you look at the host of CEOs that United has had over the last 20 or 30 years, it's not that surprising because they seem to keep hiring the same kinds of people. And so, again, I just thought it was worth mentioning. And while we were chatting earlier, I sent all of you guys something that popped up in my email just in the last hour. Facts and figures of relative profit margins in the airline industry. And of course, up at the top end is for net profit margins. You know, Southwest is up there with, I don't know, 10 or 11% or something on an annual basis. And United is down at the bottom at 5%. And, you know, they're even behind some of the regional airlines. So, and it's not just that we're trying to pick on poor Oscar because he's had his hands full, certainly. But there are a lot of people that have nothing to do with the operation that are saying, "Do these guys know what they're doing?"
Yeah, Rob. So the quote is, "Trust me, we're not telling you because we don't want to. We're deep in the middle of this stuff. I just need a bit more time." And I'm going to come to Oscar's defense again over, I think that was the right thing to say. Instead of either making up something or saying something that's going to be completely wrong. And yes, he's being conservative here. Yes, it's not what Wall Street wanted to hear, but I still think he did the responsible thing at this point because they don't have their plan fully baked. Now, you could come back and say, "Well, you knew this quarterly call was coming up. Why didn't you have that answer ahead of time?" But since the information wasn't there, I still really don't have a problem with Oscar on this one.
Well, you're absolutely right, based on what little we know, and we are not privy to an awful lot of things that go on in the industry. But, you know, whether it's Oscar or anybody else, when you rank, and let's face it, all that Wall Street cares about is, are you making any money? And if so, how much? And how much can you continue to make? Mm-hmm. That's what the shareholders care about.
Hold it. Is it me or is it the two biggest complainers are on a first name basis with Mr. Munoz?
Yeah, first name.
That's us. Yeah. Well, you know, the last time I talked to Oscar, I asked him about. No, I'm just kidding.
And how about talk to Cookie Monster lately as well?
I always have a soft spot for the Cookie Monster. Actually,
me too.
But seriously, I mean, it's not just us. It's the rest of the financial industry that is looking back not just at Oscar, but at years and years and years of performance at United saying, why can't these guys seem to get their act together? And it's not just, you know, what has Oscar done in the last 90 days, but what has the airline done in the last decade or two? And I mean, I'm not a financial guy. Maybe one of our our listeners can clarify all this and have this make sense. Because, you know, if this was Southwest, I'd be saying the same thing, except that everybody knows it's night and day difference between flying on a Southwest Airlines airplane and flying on a United Airlines airplane.
Yeah, there's another podcast called the Airline Weekly Lounge that goes into pretty good depth on the financial analysis of every airline or most every airline on a global basis. And they do a really good job of doing the analysis. I haven't listened to the show yet where they might have talked about United and get their take on it. But just if the listeners are interested in a really good podcast that talks about the financial analysis, I could definitely recommend the Airline Weekly Lounge for that.
Yeah, it's a good show.
I've never heard of that. I will check that out myself.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I would add to this stuff, finally, though, is, I mean, this is, it's complaining by financial analysts at an earnings call. And they're kind of an interesting breed, these financial analysts. They like to hear you say what you've said in the past would happen. They like to hear you say what they believe will happen with a company. And they want certainty looking forward because they're trying to figure out, you know, their investment strategies. And having a reliable forecast of the future is what they prefer. So when they hear, in this case, I guess, the truth that to answer your question completely, you're going to have to wait because we're still working on the answer, that doesn't play real well with that group.
No, not at all.
I don't think that the complaint or the fear, let's say, of this group concerning the future of United is something that's relevant to many people broadly. I just don't know. Oh, I know people
I
don't will
know.
Disagree.
By the time a company gets to the size of United, the expectations are really well established. And so, you know, everyone, I think the points that were made here with respect to knowing that an earnings call is coming up, having the proper actionable numbers-based answers about what we're doing, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, those expectations are reasonable for a startup. But I think there's been a lot of really relevant discussion with the impact of technology companies and other high-growth companies and, a changing of the guard in terms of leadership, that there's an intrinsic diametric opposite, right, between the language of the opportunists who see vision and who see opportunity and who speak in qualitative terms about gigantic untapped markets and all of these things, and what financially driven people are interested in, which is, okay, that's great, but you can't measure it. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. And coming together on that topic is the answer to how you make money. A company getting started doesn't have to do a lot of this sort of thing. A company that's well established, it's what it's all about. So getting in the middle and putting things into a form where you can really get leadership, you can really get engagement, that's the challenge for the CEO. And, you know, obviously United's in the news because they're not doing it.
Could I make mention of that one note I put in there, Max, about the CEOs?
Sure.
I just wondered if anybody could go back over the last 30 years or so and tell us, give us the names of the CEOs United has had. I couldn't go very far. I mean, I went back to, before Oscar, there was Jeff Smyzik and Glenn Tilton before that, and I lost it. I don't know. Maybe one of our really smart readers, one of our really smart listeners can give us the historic look at United over the last 20 or 30 years, because there have been quite a few CEOs.
Hey, the only decent decision that Stephen Wolf ever made was the overhead bins of the 777 and having United be the launch customer for the 777. Besides that, I really don't have anything positive to say about what he did for United either.
Oh, no. And of course, there was Ferris in there and, and none of them have been spectacular from an analyst state. And that's why when this came up, I don't disagree with what we're talking about in terms of, you know, giving Oscar a break and all that. But I'm looking more on a historic basis that go back 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15, And it's kind of the same story. Mm-hmm. United's always been trailing, and you just have to ask why.
Well, and I think part of what's caused the issue that they currently face over not knowing the data is because they've come up with this crazy idea of basic economy, and they don't have a full picture of the numbers yet because they did such a terrible rollout of basic economy. And they're just stuck in this position where they don't have enough data at this point to make an accurate forecast. And on the one hand, it's been great for the company because so many people hate basic economy, they've paid to upgrade to normal economy. And that's been a good financial windfall for United. But on the other hand, it's just been a disastrous rollout, and they've lost an awful lot of customers as a result of it. So you're just in a pile of the middle, and they just don't know what side they're going to come out on at this point.
Well, the board can't be 100% thrilled with Mr. Munoz. I can't say Oscar's name. That's why we say Oscar.
See, that's why we say Oscar.
There we go. I figured it out. But remember back earlier in the year, he was named Communicator of the Year by PR Week, just about the same time that the doctor was dragged off the aircraft. And previously, he was scheduled to take a broader role as chairman of the company, and then they postponed that. So clearly, they're kind of going, you know, we're not really willing to give you great, you know, full control of the company. So I think even the board is just kind of holding back a little bit and playing wait and see with him.
All right. Let's conclude the United Airlines segment of the show and move on to, let's talk about Airbus. Brian, Airbus had a recent milestone, a nice milestone.
Yeah, they did the first flight of the A330neo, which makes me wonder, why the heck are they doing a Neo version of the A330? So they were all really proud of this, but I just, unless if there's a lot of economies for airlines to, because they have their pilots trained already on the 330, to me, it just seems like it's a older, slower, heavier version of the A350 that they're trying to sell. So they just seem to be cannibalizing their own sales. And I just don't understand why this plane's even coming to market.
I can say something about that. I'm pretty much a Boeing guy, but Airbus is really kicking butt these days with a number of things that are really focused on the aerodynamic side of innovation. And that's really where, frankly, all the action is in aircraft development anyway. Even when we're talking about engines, you know, we'll talk a little bit about 3D printing later and its impact on things like making a jet engine. But aside from the nuts and bolts of how something's made, really all of the efficiencies are related to the aerodynamic efficiencies of turbofan engines and the aerodynamic efficiencies of the airframe itself. So, you know, in this case, the A330neo has got 210 foot of wingspan. And although it's a little smaller or shorter, rather, in its effectiveness in shorter range operations, that's where it really has some big advantages. And there's a need for airliners to work more effectively in short haul operations. So in some cases there, it's going to be putting some pressure on its competition.
But is it going to be significantly more efficient than the A350? And if you were an airline, wouldn't you rather buy the 787?
Well, that's I think that's part of the issue, is that Airbus is seeing a lot of sales going to the 787 that they wish they could capture. And I think the 330neo is in part a response to that. But it is more efficient, right? You've got the, in this case, Rolls-Royce engines, the Trent 7000. Airbus wanted a sole source situation here for the engines. So there's no GE engine offered. There's no Pratt engine offered. It's a 112-inch Trent 7000. You get some efficiencies from that. They say about 11% more efficiency on the engine. That's offset by increased weight, additional drag, but of the larger engine, larger diameter engine. But John, as you say, they've done some optimization on the aerodynamics with sharklets and I guess some other things.
Well, that the engine, for one thing, is more than 10% more efficient. You get a bigger fan, and of course, most of the thrust of a jet engine really comes from the fan. And so all of the latest generation of re-engined aircraft have a massive improvement because of a larger amount of thrust from bigger fans. But the bottom line is it's 12% more fuel efficient, especially in a shorter haul application. And a Dreamliner is great, but it's really optimized for a longer haul.
Right. Yeah.
And are you saying the same thing's true for the A350 as well? That the efficiencies just aren't there of this brand new aircraft?
Well, it's not just, you know, what's the efficiency of one aircraft versus the other in terms of fuel efficiency. I mean, it's the, you know, cost per revenue passenger mile. Different missions, I think, that the that the two aircraft would fly. So it's not a comparison of, you know, this airplane versus that airplane, which airplane is more efficient. It's, you know, which is more efficient in terms of the routes that it would be flown in. For the A330neo, the largest customer in terms of orders placed is AirAsia X, right? The Malaysian airline. That's a low cost airline for the, you know, the missions that they anticipate there. Air Lease Corporation is has a bunch of these on orders. Iran Air does as well, interestingly enough. And Delta has 25 on order. So they have 206 of the Dash 900 model Neos on order, only 6 of the Dash 800. So combined, the order book stands at 212, which is not a huge number, but still early. Okay, let's just finish up on the news segment with a sad note. We learned that just recently Ben Sandilands passed away. He was the editor of Plane Talking, a longtime aviation journalist in Australia. Rob, you must be familiar with the work that Ben has done over the decades, really.
Oh, sure. And even he was writing right up until, I think, 2 days before he died, because I forgot what the exact, I always think of him as Crikey. I don't know.
Yeah.
Somehow that K-R-I-K-E-Y, Crikey.com, or, you know, that was kind of the way he was known, although that may not be the exact URL of the site, but I always liked it because I would go up there and sometimes the most inane topics, and I'd look and he had, you know, 80 comments or something, you know, and I'd go, wow, what does this guy do? You know, I mean, because he's a really popular guy in that part of the world. And then I found out that Stephen Grant knew him and they had him on the Plane Crazy Down Under a number of times. And so when I saw this the other day, I thought, oh, what a shame. And I guess it was very unexpected. He was ill, but nobody expected him to go very quickly like this.
We also, again, heard from Grant McCarran, and he said that, or he tells us that he received an email from Ben's daughter late on Friday. That was the day that he died, telling me, that being Grant, that he passed peacefully with both his sister and daughter with him. While he could be cranky at times, he had great insights and wasn't afraid to speak his mind. I enjoyed our discussions and emails regarding aviation and transport, and we'll miss his updates. So thanks, Grant, for kind of sending that along. His last posting in Plane Talking was October 20th, where he was talking about Malaysia. Refocusing renewed search on MH370. So we'll put a link in the show notes to that in the Crikey blog. I have seen that some of the comments under it, people are responding to the news of his death. I don't know if there will be another way to express any thoughts that you'd like to the family, but there's at least that right now.
And Rob, it's Crikey with a C, not a K.
Did I say K? I'm sorry. I meant C.
This episode, we're talking with John McGinnis, founder and CEO of Synergy Aircraft, about the work that he's doing. John, we're interested in hearing your views about the process of creating a new aircraft in a general context. So there are a lot of steps, there are a lot of people involved, a lot of hard work, a lot of time, years of time, it seems, and all with no guarantee of commercial success in the end. Maybe to start off, you can walk us through the process a little bit. Again, in the general sense.
Okay.
Where does it start?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to take all of your CDs and stock certificates and empty your wallet into the backyard refuse container and light them on fire. And then you repeat that process rather frequently. And each time it's 100 orders of magnitude larger.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But, you know, the truth is that it depends on the scale. There's a spectrum of answers here. There's a spectrum of airplanes. So a lot of times we take our tour through the Boeing plant and we say, wow, of course, no wonder, $100 million a piece or more. And that's not really what I'm doing, not by any stretch of the imagination. You know, it is possible to go build your own airplane with almost nothing and not really be taking much in the way of new risks there. So I think that the question is, best answered is to don't go out on a limb, you know, stay in range of whatever it is that your expertise is. And I'm endlessly fascinated by the fact that I'm now doing something that I didn't think I would ever be doing. It just turned out that over time, all the things that I had done in the past with regard to 3D solid modeling, 3D printing, huge amount of composite construction work, including production high-speed composite construction, where we made some breakthroughs in how fast you could make something and how low-cost the process could be and the tooling. So those things kind of all came together to allow me an opportunity, and I wasn't even looking for it when I managed to make a breakthrough in a rather fundamental area. In 2005, was just looking to build an airplane for my snowboard company. And the company that I had selected encouraged me to look into updates to their aircraft or maybe designing them a new airplane for them. I've really been designing planes and flying originally designed planes since I was 5 years old. They didn't get any good till I was 13 and paying attention to guys like Bert Rutan. But this is not a difficult art. It's actually one of the things that tens of thousands of people are very good at, which is designing airplanes.
John, do you think Bert Rutan influenced a lot of people?
Yeah, he influenced millions and millions and millions of people. Yeah, I started paying attention in 74, and by 75, I was convinced everyone on the planet knew who he was. And of course, really, that wasn't the case, but within the realm of inspiring young people in particular to look at things that were novel, construction techniques, configurations, aerodynamics, radical attitudes about what you can do and how you can do it. That was a huge part of what I sort of took for granted as I got more serious about aerodynamics and was reading papers and things like that.
Was there sort of an aha moment where this concept sort of coalesced in your brain?
Yeah, it was a mind-blowing experience. I told Velocity, who was the company we were looking at buying a kit from, that I couldn't take on a project like that. I was just too busy. I had a gazillion things going on. But I did nevertheless go back and see if I had missed any things since the last time I had poked my head through the door of what a good airplane would look like for a family. And that process led to reading on the internet things that would normally have been separated in time for me. They would have been separated by months or years. But now I was reading papers that were relevant for written in the 30s and written in the 50s and written in the 70s and written in the 80s and 90s. And it turns out that if you could have ever gotten those guys in the same room, you know, people from Max Munch up to Elon Crow, there would have been some big thermonuclear reactions going on as they put pieces together that were widely separated. Because a lot of the real breakthroughs in aeronautics were practiced by solo individuals. There were just a handful of guys in the world who had an intimate grasp on what was going on conceptually. So anyway, that's when I was able to put a couple of pieces together with respect to induced drag and the scale of atmospheric viscosity interactions, I realized that what I had just figured out was not a small deal. It was a way of creating stability and control through drag reduction. normally you create stability and control through drag increase. And that's why all of our present architectures that have been successful look the way they do. They all have long, skinny wings and a tail back there. And that's not what a bird looks like. It's not what other natural and organic methods of flight and propulsion look like. So we've got a lot to apply, and it's been sitting there waiting for us for several decades to you know, reimagine with more powerful tools.
So with these kinds of tools available, I think that probably collapses the time it takes to do the development, to do the design.
It's unbelievable. You know, a typical laptop now has more processing power, experience, and analysis capability than the entire Boeing engineering wing did back in the day when they were designing the first jetliners.
It's kind of mind-blowing that's the case. How far ahead are you looking in the process, or were you looking in this process at the beginning? In other words, when this started to come together, did you think about all of the steps that were necessary in order to...
No, I just followed the rabbit down the hole, you know. It was a simple thing. We're like, oh, this is interesting. What's that all about? And started investigating. And the next thing you know, you are really looking at lots and lots of questions that deserve to have answers. Now I've forgotten your question altogether. Can you tell me what you're asking me?
I think I've forgotten as well. But so I was asking if how far ahead you were looking, but maybe you can talk about the steps that are involved in getting from an idea in your head through a prototype to a full scale to something that actually flies.
Well, and normally that's really simple because we thought we had all the configurations figured out, and so you take what your favorite configurations look like, and most of that is conceptual design. So you're conceiving of something that might have a particular shape or wingspan or aspect ratio or, you know, something not too far removed from standard practice. But in this case, it was completely different. And conceptual design for something that hasn't been done before is usually just an exercise in fantasy. People are imposing a design and they're saying, hey, what about this crazy idea? In my case, I did that for a minute, and then I realized that it wasn't going to be possible to really iterate that way. And so I kind of took a primitive algorithmic approach to it, which was to say, I don't know what this thing looks like. Let's apply the best practice principles here and see what we get. And a lot of my looking at the plane wasn't really looking to the future. It was looking to the past. In the 1930s, biplane theory left 25% of its domain unexplored. We knew about three kinds of biplanes, but the fourth kind of biplanes we didn't do any investigation with. And that was the actual category of dumb ideas that were the one wing of the biplane is above and behind and is created to push down instead of create lift. So there was that rattling around in my brain. Another part of it was rattling around was all of the unexplored principles for laminar flow and active drag reduction, powered drag reduction. So there's huge amounts of stuff in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s that were being rediscovered by a new group every time. And by the 80s, when Goldschmidt got a hold of it at NASA, there were some very provocative tests done. And unfortunately, they were explored in a way that didn't give them any credibility. Nevertheless, there was a certain amount of credibility that was achieved and a certain amount of success that was duplicated by others later on. And I knew all about this stuff. I mean, I was intimate with it. I'd done a bunch of experimentation and learned some of the governing principles. One of the most important things is to do any experiments with this that have any relevance. You've got to be big and you've got to be fast compared to a home-built airplane. It's got to be a bigger than normal plane, and it's got to be a lot faster than normal before you get to the realm where your improvements would make a difference. So all of that was, for me, how I got to the conceptual stage. And then you do about 100 times more work and you do preliminary design. So preliminary design is putting all your numbers in spreadsheets and analysis and simulators and whatever tools you have available. And then you got to go beyond that with your scale model testing. You could do a wind tunnel, but a wind tunnel is a device that's nothing like the atmosphere. It's okay that it's nothing like the atmosphere for most testing, but for the kind of testing we would be doing, it basically swallows the data. It doesn't let you get real induced drag numbers. It doesn't let you get real low turbulence, non-affected drag numbers for the high Reynolds number, high-speed regime we'd be operating in. So it's kind of useless to do wind tunnels. Besides that, if you had lightweight miniature telemetry systems and radio control systems like we have today, we probably wouldn't have spent all the money on a lot of the wind tunnels. We would simply have done what we do now, is fly a large scale, dynamically similar aircraft models.
So I want to come back to the testing, but first, talk a little bit about the, you know, the aircraft design itself. This is something that it's got a very different kind of a look. And if for those of you listening, be sure to go to the show notes, and we'll have some photos there, plus, of course, links to the Synergy Aircraft website with a lot more. But this uses what you call a double box tail concept. Is that something that was a feature of this airplane from the pretty much from the beginning?
It was the genesis of what became this airplane. That was the inventive moment, which was to realize that there was a class of configurations that were potentially able to do something new with the way we treat wake vortex. Normally, you have a wingtip vortex off of each wingtip and a similar lifting vortex off every lifting surface, and we have a bunch of those on a plane. On Synergy, there isn't really a wing tip. We have a continued wing up to the winglet. Winglet goes up and connects to the tail, and the tail goes over and connects to a V-tail, and the V-tail goes down and connects to a boom tube. So by the time you have allowed the lift production mechanism to occur, you've done it in a way that puts the vortex where you want it to be, which is ideally in the middle to allow a small amount of air to be efficiently directed downward to create your lift. So the goals that can be achieved with a closed lifting system like this generally include reductions of induced drag. To bring it back to like the news story, for example, you know, an airliner like the A330neo is going to be about 40% or so of its drag in typical operation is going to be from this weight per wingspan. And the more weight you have for your wingspan, the more fundamental your induced drag component is going to be. And a configuration like this one has a span efficiency that's 46% better than the best of a flat wing design. It's way better than winglets.
Hmm. There are a couple of images, and maybe you can help understand what they are. And again, we'll put these in the show notes, but there's a conventional kind of airplane, the high wing airplane, and there's the Synergy, and the representation is drag or the vortices coming off of the surfaces, and there's quite a difference between the two designs.
One of the things that you can really see with when you run a conventional airplane through CFD is that we're stirring up a lot of air, and we're using that turbulence in ways that create the drag problem. So we do have some imaging of something like a Cessna 172, and it's visually obvious with CFD work that probably not the best architecture for an airplane in this class. When you run the same thing for Synergy, the simulation runs several times faster because there's basically no drag to calculate it. It's amazing the difference in how even a numerical approach to the same question reveals some of these factors. Like a typical small airplane doesn't have laminar flow anywhere. You get a good one, a modern one, and it'll have laminar flow wings. But really, the wings don't make much of the drag. The fuselage and the propulsion system are the drag source. So there aren't any small single-engine aircraft that really have laminar flow as a governing design principle in the fuselage. If you make laminar flow with the fuselage, you can cut your drag in half. And there's another step beyond that where if you use some of your engine power to reduce the drag, you can cut the drag in half yet again. So that sheds light on this much bigger question and problem, which is how come we don't have smaller airplanes instead of the hub and spoke airline system. And the answer really is nobody can make any money at it until you can create a comparable cost per seat mile. The status quo really won't change. And there are ways to create a comparable cost per seat mile, but they don't let you utilize lesser developed resources or infrastructure. So even though you can take off and land and off any quarter mile grass strip in a lot of planes, those planes won't deliver the economy and the utility to get your grandma and your three grandkids to go along with you on a flight, right? It's it's not going to be something that they want to do in a typical small airplane. But if you could make it big and roomy and comfortable like a car, and it had the kind of economy of a car, but it was six times as fast, you'd be in the realm of where we ought to be, which is competitive with airliners. On a cost per seat mile basis, you could be less than a nickel with the kind of aerodynamics that we're talking about.
And that's the goal that you're trying to achieve, right? In effect, almost a personal airplane, but one that has these kinds of efficiencies that are not common in the, you know, in the current fleet of general aviation aircraft.
Yeah, I kind of signed up for this one because I just wanted to fly. I still just want to fly. But I also realized that I had an obligation. This was my big chance to do something that would really change human behaviors. There aren't enough people who know what I know that could really actively engage with these opportunities unless we could get something built and flying and really start to show how impactful that could be.
Back to testing in the sort of the current status of this project, you're currently flying scale models, is that correct?
Yeah, we've done a bunch of scale model development work. We've done a huge amount of CFD and analysis work using the most powerful tools that are presently available. And I would like to finish and fly my plane as soon as I can. It's a one to seven seat aircraft. We've got it configured for six. And, you know, that's not something I was really able to afford on my own. So I kind of tried to make it so that the asset that I'd create over time would be of business value. And the result of that asset would be something that makes the business case. I'd really like it to go faster than that, though, because at this point in time, we've already validated everything and we've got such an engagement with people who'd want one yesterday. It'd be great to get things going in parallel, and I wouldn't have to try to fund both efforts out of pocket.
Well, let me ask our pilots in the group here, Rob and Max T, as pilots, when you look at this design, at this aircraft, what comes to mind? What kind of questions do you have?
I think the question that comes to my mind is probably the same that I've had with the deluge of new aircraft that have been pilotless air taxis and new generation flying cars and all that. I guess how do you compete with a market that looks like somebody's opened the fence and everybody's in it these days, maybe in the last 12 months alone?
Well, no one's in MySpace. Zero. What we're looking at are aircraft that have a 6X aerodynamic advantage over the other guys. You know, you can't go 340 miles an hour like we can and do it all basically all day long.
Well, that's true. No, you're right. But of course, let me ask you where you are in the development process.
I'm done. The development is finished. I actually went through 32 versions just to get to the version that was undertaken in construction. We made some small changes since then, but, you know, that's the work that takes time, not just money, but really it's time. You can't pay for a 10, 12-year development project when you've got, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a month in burn rate. You've got to get that work done somehow before you go to market, hopefully. Because, I think of all these examples like someone was mentioning where we're looking at a history over the last 30, 40 years of flash-in-the-pan new airplane designs. They look great. They win a bunch of awards, cover of a magazine, and then they're gone. And the business case for why that is clear. It's always the same story, and a lot of the times it includes promising something that's essentially still vaporware, rushing to market with something that's basically your alpha version, and then trying to somehow survive and get it into the certified category, by the time you go from your $100,000 airplane that NASA promised to the $800,000 airplane that Cirrus has delivered, you can see that it's a completely different game.
Excellent point.
So if you're done, when are we going to be able to buy one?
Well, that was really the principal business task that I saw, is because, you know, there's not any technical risk here. It's just an airplane, and airplanes are really simple, especially this kind. But, you know, that's not how people see it. And they're like, what are you talking about? Airplanes are complicated and scary and expensive, and it's just not the case. They should be simpler and less expensive to mass manufacture than an automobile. But stop and think about this. You got the number one selling general aviation aircraft in 2015 was the 60-year-old Cessna 172, and we made a whopping 143 units that year. Now, in automotive, you got a billion cars on the road. Nobody needs another car. But while Max is waiting for his car to get repaired, you know, you can go drive something else. And I can place an order on my, you know, Tesla Model 3, and I'll drive my Toyota until it arrives. Nevertheless, we still make 10,000 cars per hour. So if you think about what it would mean to, you know, break down the barrier here, which is fundamental cost, and you've got something that has the potential for mass market distribution and the potential for mass market adoption, then your really only problem is the same one that Jim Beatty had 50 years ago. You know, people want this airplane. They want 12,000 of them yesterday, and you're not prepared to make one. So I wanted to solve that problem. I wanted to solve the manufacturing problem. So most of my time here has been figuring out how to integrate and design systems that reduce the parts count down to basically nothing and increase the manufacturability so that we can turn out carbon fiber airplane parts like they're turning out carbon fiber BMW parts, which is, you know, 90-second cycle times. This is the investment that's been made in the design work, is to solve the last mile of the deliverable and make a plane that, you know, everybody wants it. So at some point, I'd like to be able to get one, right? That's what we want to solve.
And so when do you, you know, kind of to go to Brian's question, when do you expect to be able to fly a, you know, a full-scale version?
It's hard for me to make expectations. I'm just, you know, I'm just a poor guy here trying to do this with very limited resources. We picked up a contract a few years ago, and I was able to run a crew and do a whole bunch of things that were peripherally beneficial. We even got some scale model development out of it. But the bottom line is that, you know, I wasn't willing to take the hundreds of millions of dollars that were prematurely offered to start up the company. I kind of know what it takes. It's not my first rodeo. So, again, looking at Tesla as the example, people look at Tesla now, $12 billion later, you know, but when it first started, it was just Elon and $6 million of his money invested in some guys who were doing the garage level work. And I'm in that garage level work. And, you know, what $6 million means to Tesla today is 0.000 nothing.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
So we've got to just get this bird in the air, and then the blank check is available. But getting it in the air with nothing is kind of hard. And I'm definitely still reaching out to people who don't necessarily pose a, you know, a business risk to the company, to help with, you know, underwriting the development of it, because it needs to be done.
I'm curious, you were talking about something over 300 knots. What kind of power plant are you expecting to put it in when you first fly it, and what kind of power?
Well, I got a Delta Hawk diesel. It's a four-cylinder turbocharged two-stroke turbo diesel, but I wanted to make the airframe engine independent, and I've done that. It's got the ability to utilize just about anything in the way of a power plant, and I'd like to see an electric integration so that no matter what power plant we might drive it with, it's probably a hybrid or pure battery electric, and the prop fan is turned by electric propulsion, and I've done that work too.
And where are the fuel tanks? I mean, the wings look pretty skinny to me.
No, they're conventionally thick, 12 to 15% thick airfoils, and the capacity for fuel is about 113 gallons.
Hmm. What's the wingspan going to be?
32 foot.
Oh, wow. So a little smaller than some of the traditional planes. It'll fit easily in a hangar.
Yeah, it's a very compact plane, but it's way bigger in the inside. You know, you can put 5 to 7 people in there, and they're not even touching each other.
Hmm.
And how about flying the plane with this double box tail? Does that require different piloting skills?
No, it's quite a bit easier. In fact, the configuration, one of the nice things that, it's not nice, it wasn't nice to me at the time because it kind of sold me down the river, but I discovered that the configuration was a novel stall preventative configuration. It had exceptional low-speed handling and control. So given that most of our smaller aircraft accidents are related to stall behaviors and loss of control at low altitude, this was a really intriguing novel technology that sucked me into the exploration. And Synergy won't stall or spin, so that's one aspect. But it's also like driving a sled on rails. It is absolutely the easiest to fly plane I've ever flown in the class that I've built it in. So I've been doing a lot of radio control modeling over the years, hundreds of different planes. And I kind of expected this to be a hot rod and twitchy, and it's exactly the opposite. It's bone dead simple.
What do you have for control surfaces? I mean, there's no conventional tail, obviously, so I'm guessing you have ailerons and other control surfaces?
No, just got the elevator function and the aileron function are both handled by the elevons,
okay,
which is just what you'd find on a flying wing, except yep, they're not on the wing. They're up above and behind in a separate pivoting control surface. And those are really all you need. We do have rudders, but that's mostly just for independent yaw control.
I see. So the rudders are the kind of the inside vertical portion of the box?
Correct. They're on the internal V-tails, and you don't use them in flight. Another aspect of this particular design is that it has balanced and coordinated turn behavior, no adverse yaw.
What kind of landing speed and stall speed do you expect?
I can fly it in level flight with power at 45 knots at 2,400 pounds flight weight. That was a requirement of the Green Flight Challenge, which we were wanting to get into at one point in time. We were registered, but we didn't get any funding or have an engine at that time. But nevertheless, it was designed around that requirement. Typical over-the-fence speed would be something like 55 knots or something like that.
Well, that's remarkable that it would land that slow and yet have such a high cruise speed.
Well, that's the game. You want to increase the speed at which you achieve your best L over D.
Well, it's a fascinating concept. You're employing some interesting, well, some things that are different in terms of the technologies that you're using in the design and the development, the manufacturing technologies, and also the design objectives, I think, are kind of a little bit unique. And the design, of course, I think that almost anyone who looks at the design is kind of attracted to it because it's so different. It's sort of an intriguing looking aircraft, kind of draws you in.
Yeah, it's great. I'm glad that people like it. I didn't expect that. In fact, the early versions I thought were pretty ugly. But after I got it into an algorithm and wasn't trying to impose the design upon it, what came out of it really struck my fancy, too. I remember the first time I ever saw it in a magazine, I was just flipping the magazine page and it popped out and I said, wow, before I realized it was my airplane.
So it's really the software that designed it as opposed to an artist or...
Yeah, no, I didn't do a doggone thing in terms of trying to impose the design.
John, this has been really a fascinating conversation. What's the best way for all of us to follow along?
Well, I think you should use my website, synergyaircraft.com. My email address is john@synergyaircraft.com. And you can find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/synergyaircraft. And anyone listening here from a business standpoint wants to reach me through LinkedIn, that'd be great. I'd be happy to connect.
All right. Very good. John McGinnis, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and with our listeners. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Brian, you attended an open house recently, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Here, the airport relatively close to me, San Gabriel Valley, did a open house, and they did a classic car show along with it. So there was a whole bunch of general aviation aircraft there and lots of kids hanging around. And I think a good time had by alls. It was actually my first time going to a local community airport open house event. And it was fun, so definitely encourage our listeners to, if there's one in your neighborhood, go attend. It's a lot of fun.
You have a couple of photos here. Is this a B-25?
You know, I don't think so, because the gun turret and the nose didn't look right.
It's a PBJ-2, which is a naval version or a Marine Corps version of a B-25, so I'll stop you there. It's a B-25.
Okay.
It is?
It's a B-25. It's in blue because it was Navy and Marine Corps, otherwise known as a PBJ, Patrol Bomber North American.
For all of them, was there only one gun in the nose, or did they modify this? Because this one just had one gun.
There are multiple noses on B-25s. The glass nose bomber version, which came to fame because of the Doolittle Raiders, had one .50 caliber that was used by the Bombardier Navigator. It was in a flex mount through the nose. However, over time, there was various noses added to the B-25s. There were 8.50 calibers in a strafing nose. There was also a cannon that fired 30-millimeter shells, as well as guns, as well as the gun packs. But the common fit for the bomber version, the straight medium bomber version, was a .50 caliber in a flex mount in the nose.
Hmm. So variations over time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll mention Mary Kirby and I put out another PaxX podcast episode. This was a very different one, very interesting one. We talked with Becca Alkema, who's the operations manager over at the Runway Girl Network. But most significantly for this episode is she's the mother of a severely allergic child. And in this podcast episode, we talk about some of the difficulties of air travel with folks who are allergic to nuts and pets and things like that. So it's an interesting conversation. We also talk about the WestJet 737 MAX aircraft that they've just taken delivery of. So find that over at paxxpodcast.com. And we'll have a link, of course, in the show notes. All right. For our airline story of the week, we have something a little bit different. And this is kind of an editorial piece, and it's from our main man, Micah. And he calls this Rave On. So let's listen to Micah.
As Buddy Holly once said, well, the little things you say and do make me want to tear my hair out sometimes. Well, maybe that's not exactly what he said. Plus, it's a bit too late for me. Most of my hair has been gone for some time now. But anyway, I'm a bit frustrated and just can't take it any longer. I've got to say something. What is it about this crazy new desire to search out a positive airline story every week? Sure, I know we got some emails saying that we pick on the airlines or that we report too many negative airline stories. But you know, that's 100% malarkey. The fact that we have to dig to find a positive airline story is proof itself. There's just not much positive about regular airline service these days. We've reported facts and unbiased stories demonstrating that. Let's remember that most things in this life fall on a normal curve, a bell curve, or a Likert scale. Most things on that scale fall to the middle, the average being in the center. Not so with airline service, though. Not currently, anyway. In terms of customer service, many major airlines, and the three major U.S. legacy carriers in particular, fall to the bottom of the scale. And that gets worse if we include those alleged, and I quote, low-cost carriers, unquote. When surveyed for the best service, the top three U.S. airlines come out in this order: Alaska Airlines, Virgin America, and then JetBlue, none of which are considered majors. Being that Alaska just bought Virgin America, that cuts it down to two, with Southwest often taking the next place. Yes, those are the best, but it doesn't mean they're good when compared to past service levels. or to the kind of service offered by some of the international airlines like EVA Air, Turkish Airlines, Etihad, Cathay Pacific, Qatar, and Emirates, among others. Just look at the news reporting we've done here at the Airplane Geeks. On September 20, 2017, episode 470, one of the news stories was, coach class seats are so tight that FAA dummies keep shattering seatback video screens with their heads during crash simulations. On August 30, 2017, episode 467 in the story, what caused short-haul traffic decline in the U.S.? The $34 billion question. Our own former host, Courtney Miller, discusses three theories why U.S. short-haul traffic under 500 miles has declined by almost 30% since the year 2000. Those reasons include, 1, airline consolidation has led to a drop in short-haul service, 2, pricing has increased disproportionately on short-haul segments, and 3, increased security requirements and hassle factor have made alternative surface transportation favorable to flying on short sectors. That story shows airline travel is down in 300 to 500-mile segments, distances that can be driven, or where there might be good train service like the Northeast Corridor. People don't want the hassle of an airport, of the silly security theater, of the poor quality service, of being herded onto aircraft and cattle class and held in tiny stall-like seats like baby veal. Now bear in mind, I include myself in that segment. On my trips to New York City, 300 miles from where I live, Washington, D.C., 600 miles from me, and even to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a 700-mile journey, I drive rather than fly. I choose to drive, even though the latter two trips cost me an extra day and a hotel overnight in each direction. That means driving takes much more time and is much more expensive than flying. Yet I choose to drive anyway. Bear in mind, this means I'm choosing to pay more and spend more time traveling, even though I love to fly, and commercial flying is pretty much the only kind of flying I have available to me. If I love to fly and still go for alternative transportation, what do you suppose those who don't enjoy flying choose? We need to remember, we don't make the news. We just report it. When Rob talked about the terrible situation his daughter faced while trying to depart Chicago on United, he wasn't intentionally disparaging. He was informing listeners about what happened and what can be expected as commercial passengers. When Brian gave us his trip report about his journey to South Africa, he was fair and equitable in praising what was good and reporting what was bad. It was critical he reported all the things he experienced on United, South African Airways, and Lufthansa. Remember, even though Brian had paid for and was flying first class in a first-class cabin with first-class prices, he still had some true steerage class service at times. That's unacceptable and needs to be reported. When I returned from Farnborough last year and United canceled my connecting flight back to Newark to Portland, I reported what happened fairly. Even though there were weather issues and United had no obligation nor requirement to take care of me overnight, they went above and beyond and gave me a hotel and meal vouchers for my inconvenience. Even though the morning flights were sold out, United found me a seat and got me home on the first flight out, something even the amazing cranky concierge couldn't do with all his magic. But I reported that United failed to tag my bag at Heathrow, and it didn't arrive until the day after I did. I reported both the good and bad about my experience. Now, it might be said that the Airplane Geeks is about airplanes, and not about the passenger experience, and that we have a sister podcast for passenger information. But like me, many listeners' current ability to fly is only as commercial passengers, and they need to know what's going on in the sky and what to expect. Additionally, while the PAX X podcast does a wonderful job of reporting what could happen and what the experience could be like and what future plans are for airline passengers, it does not generally report on actual experiences of actual passengers. There's little information on the details that Joe Schmo experiences when flying commercially. Lastly, the need to dig as deep as we do to find at least one positive airline story each week demonstrates that there is little positive about airlines to report. Sure, on occasion something makes the headlines. For example, JetBlue capping prices to help evacuate people out of Hurricane Irma was a real news story and needed to be reported as part of the news, but not held out as a separate special, quote, positive airline story of the week, unquote. If the true story of what's happening with airline service is not discussed, is not brought to the attention to both the regular flying public and the once-a-year flyer, then there's no impetus for the airlines to improve service. It makes us complacent. It makes us cattle. And that's what the airlines want from their passengers. As airplane geeks, we have a responsibility, an obligation even, to try to point out this continued airline race to the bottom and try to stop it as best we can. The airplane geeks always have and always will mean a lot to me, and I know it does to many listeners. I've always felt I can count on the show for great information and fair and unbiased reporting of aviation news stories. But this recent editorial shift of not reporting or leaving out the real stories of the current state of airline service does justice to neither the heritage of the podcast nor its listeners. I hope, my friends and listeners, that you don't see this as a voice of dissent, but as a reasonable discussion of what I've been hearing for the past few months. You need to know that words cannot express how proud I am to be contributor at large to this magnificent podcast. I just don't think this obviously forced reporting strategy is who we are, nor who we want to be. Maybe it's time to consider revising the thought process. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Okay. Way to go, Micah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I can't disagree with him. I said it too when we sort of started down this road ages ago. I didn't understand it. I don't know that that's going to change anything, but I think what he said is certainly true. There aren't very many positive airline stories out there, either because they aren't happening or the airlines are not reporting them. But I don't see it as our job to go out and find them. Let the airlines, you know, manage huge communications and marketing staff to do that. Let them bring the darn stories to us, and we'll be happy to tell them.
The thing is, I actually enjoy searching for them and reporting upon them when I find them. Mike has certainly given me something additional to think about, but I don't know. I'd still go back to, is there something wrong with finding positive stories and talking about what happens in the airline industry?
I don't think there is at all. Not at all, Brian. And I don't want to make it sound like I don't want to hear any positive stories. I just don't think we need a segment that's named the positive airline story of the week. I mean, why not also have a positive GA safety story of the week, or, you know, we could go on and on. I mean, well, if you well, find you used one, to great.
Do the You used to do the aviation minute.
Uh-huh. Oh, so no. Could. As I said, I'm not disagreeing it. I just think if you want to do it, that's fine. I just don't know that we're going to get very far, because I don't know that there are that many stories out there.
Like I said, it is a challenge finding them.
And I think you need more friends at Delta, United, Eastern. Oh, my God. Did I say
wow.
that?
Wow.
I'll throw TWA in there, too.
Well, there is an Eastern these days anyway, but it's all charter. But, you know, they ought to be finding you going, hey, Brian, we heard you're after good positive stories. We've got a few. In fact, I hope somebody will. Maybe. Yeah. Do we know anybody at Delta that could help you? Or,
in a way, it's all news. I mean, as we think of news here, I mean, so what is the news? I mean, it's stories that have brought impact on aviation enthusiasts. It's stories that introduce us to new aspects of aviation that we may not be familiar with, new technologies. It's all of those things, and that really can include issues with airline travel, either positive or negative. It's all kind of a balance, I think. And I think creating a separate segment per se, as we've sort of done here, I don't think that necessarily has a long-term future, but I guess I would think that stories about aviation that are of interest to us and to the listeners that put up with us. It's all candidates for inclusion in the podcast.
Yeah. But to Brian's point, he does make a good point. I mean, if that's what did we used to say? Hey, Brian, if that's your thing, you know, trying to find positive airline stories, go for it, man.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe since Max T is so good at putting up Twitter surveys or in Slack, should we ask our listeners, is it a segment that they enjoy listening to or not? Yeah, you know, should it, I feel like I'm on a radio station with a make it or break it, right? They play a song and yeah, you know, should they break the LP and never play it again or yeah. put it in rotation?
No. We're overthinking it. And I don't.
Oh, we don't need to listen to our listeners? Okay, good.
No, I don't.
Well, let's see. When was the last listener survey? It was probably what, about a year ago? Maybe it's time to do one again.
Oh, hell no.
Wait, I was going to say, wait until we do the survey and they say, you know, that Max T guy, we're kind of tired of him. Oh.
Oh, is that how this works?
I mean, we already know they hate my jokes, but I've tried to get better at that.
Are we going to get voted off the island? Is this a reality podcast show now?
Oh,
good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think so.
We're generally on a 2-year cycle for surveys, so people don't get, tired of doing that. But we're always interested in feedback, of course, and so you can write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Tell us what you think about this whole topic. You can write an email. We really like recordings. You can just spend a minute or two with your phone or something and just record a little bit of your thinking on this. That would be great. But either way, send it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We, in the interest of pushing forward, we do have a few emails from listeners we want to talk about. I'm afraid to do the first one because it's kind of like it's a complaint about an airline. But
oh no, how did that happen?
So this is from Brett, and he was on a recent Delta flight, and he was crammed into a window seat. It was full. Immediately ahead of him. In the row, there was no one seated. Now, this was
I think it was a windowless seat, wasn't it?
It might have been, but the row ahead of him was like Economy Plus or something. It had a little extra extra leg room, and there was nobody sitting there. So before the plane departed, he moved up to that one of those open seats. Everybody else had been seated in the airplane, and the flight attendant didn't like that. Sent him back. He thought it was kind of a stupid rule that he couldn't move up.
A safety concern.
So okay. So before
should
we get
the
to
airplane
that,
go should the airplane go down? They need to know who's in what seat.
Okay, so you're jumping ahead. So just
keep
that in mind. So
no.
Brett sent us a little short video. So here's the audio from it. It kind of describes the situation.
Hello, Airplane Geek Podcast. Well, I'm on this flight here where we're squeezed in by a bunch of sardines. This is the flight that I wanted to move forward to one of these luxurious seats that has some additional room in. So I moved up there, and before they closed the door, the steward came back and said, you can't sit there because you didn't pay for one of those seats. But I said, you know, that seat's empty. Can I sit there? No, that's against the rules. I said, you know what? Those are stupid rules. Anyway, he told me if I had a problem with it, I needed to take it up on the Delta website, which I'm sure that would revolutionize the industry if I did that. So I'm just going to complain about this on the internet, and that'll make myself maybe feel better. But it's just ridiculous that when an airline is packed like this is, I have very little room between myself and the other passenger that I cannot move up to one of these other seats. So I'm going to record this and send this to you guys. Maybe you'll have a kick out of it because I know you love picking on the airline signs.
David, you raised the issue of...
Okay, first of all, Brett, you want a bigger seat? Pay for it. I'm 6'4". I have to pay for a bigger seat every time. Second of all, should the airplane go down, it's the only way they know who's where.
I'm not buying that. I mean, I've changed seats on airlines before, and you know, I don't think they went to a seating chart and changed it.
No, but I think the issue with this is, would and Brett, sorry for picking on you here, but would you ever consider moving from economy to first class if there was an open seat in first class? I hope the answer is no to that. And on Delta, they sell those seats as Comfort Plus. The fact that they don't put a curtain that separates regular economy from the Comfort Plus section is possibly confusing to customers, but it's a separate product that they sell for a higher fee. Therefore, I think that the flight attendant was right in saying that you should remain in your seat. And as David said, if you're looking for the extra room and you're uncomfortable, well, sorry, you got to pay for it. In my mind, that's just the way it goes. I also wonder if there were an awful lot of seats available in the Comfort Plus section, if that would affect the weight and balance of the aircraft. I know I've been on smaller planes where they haven't been completely full, and they have moved passengers to either more to the front. Most of the time, it's getting everyone to the back of the plane. So our two pilot guys, could this possibly affect weight and balance if enough people moved?
Boy, it depends on how big their plane.
I can only tell you that in the old days when I flew 19-seat turboprops, I mean, part of the first officer's training was to memorize the seat blocking. That if you had 19 seats, it was easy. The weight and balance all worked out. But if you had 12 passengers or perhaps seven, you had to very closely watch where they went to make sure that all the weight didn't end up in the trunk. And now on a big airplane, I don't think it's quite as critical if a couple of people moved over. But I have to agree with David and Brian. You know, there's a lot of things I'd like the airlines to be that resemble what they used to be, but it's not going to happen. And if you want the bigger seat, you got to pay for it. It's that simple.
All right, let's move on to Mick. He sent us a link to a YouTube video. This is Air Show Paris 1989. Now, I'll be honest with you. When someone sends along a video and it's a one-hour video, my first reaction is, boy, I don't have an hour to watch this. But I started to watch it because I wanted to, you know, see generally what it was about. Well, an hour later, after watching the entire video, this is fantastic. It includes a description of that MiG-29 crash. I had forgotten that that thing was that long ago. Probably everybody's seen the video. This is where the thing, you know, does a nose plant.
Where the pilot got out 2 seconds before it hit or something.
Right, right. I just did not remember that that was 1989. Boy, that was amazing. So there's a lot of coverage of that. The Su-27, the first time outside of Russia. Another fascinating part of this was the F-16 demo flight. Unlike most documenting videos of a F-16 demo flight, which are showing the F-16 flying in the air, most of this video is from inside the cockpit, showing the heads-up display and the cockpit audio. And David, I mean, you probably realize this, but this thing saw a maximum of 9 Gs in this routine, in this flight. And when you hear the audio of the pilot and his breathing and his forced breathing, you know, to do the high G
thing. Prevent G-lock.
Right. Boy, I had never, ever heard anything like that. And it gave me a completely different and much more accurate view of what it's like to perform like that in that kind of an aircraft from the pilot's perspective. I thought that was really amazing.
Boy, I'm stunned that the human body can, you know, stay conscious at 19 Gs. That's pretty phenomenal.
Nine.
Oh, thank you. I heard 19.
Sorry. Maybe I misspoke.
But it's training. I have a nephew who just went through naval flight school about 2 years ago, and he sent us videos of being in the not only the centrifuge, but them training to do these breathing exercises in high G maneuvers where they kind of clench their teeth and kind of breathe, kind of suck the air between their teeth. And it's just, they just beat it into them that that's the only way you can stop from passing out in some of these high G maneuvers. Me, 3 G's and I'm wrecked.
Yeah. There's a lot of other interesting things in this video. There's the beach starship. You can see the prototype of the Piaggio Avanti flying. Many other, there's a mock-up of the, remember the X-30 aerospace plane? Well, there's a mock-up of that. Remember, this is 1989, and back then the planned first flight was 1995. So that didn't happen. The Sanger hypersonic mock-up, there was a concept for a hydrogen-powered Airbus. And I even noticed in the background as they were sort of panning across some of the display areas, an unducted fan engine. This was one with the rear counter-rotating fan blades. And I'm pretty sure it's the GE unducted fan.
And that was on a DC-9 or an MD-80.
Right.
On the left side of the aircraft. Right,
on the port side, yes. And it flew a number of times on that airplane. Now, at the same time, there was another kind of competing concept. Pratt & Whitney and Allison together had what they call the prop fan. So it looked a lot like this. The prop fan was geared, actually, while the GE UDF, the unducted fan, was not geared. So there's a difference there. So as I was, you know, thinking about these things, I dug out a video that is from aerospacenews.com, and it actually is discussing, it's an old video, but it's actually discussing those two unducted fan engines. So I'll put a link in the show notes, of course, to this video. And if you think you have anywhere close to an hour that you can spend, I think it's well worth it. Really, really amazing video.
Yeah, Max, it sucked an hour out of my day today.
Did you watch it? I just couldn't stop watching it. All right, we're running a bit long. We did hear from Patrick, who sent us the response that he had received from his Congressman Chris Stewart, who represents the 2nd District of Utah, on the topic of ATC privatization. And this is perhaps one of the best responses I've seen from the collection we've received from you all, from your elected officials. And a part of it may be that this congressman is a former B-1 bomber pilot and so has a kind of a unique perspective. But it's a really positive response. He says, you know, as you're aware, our ATC system is outdated, need of serious reform, talks about the money being invested, talks about the privatization of ATC in other countries and what the results have been there. But he notes that the U.S. airspace is the largest and most complex in the world, and there is still some uncertainty of the implications privatization might have. One of my larger concerns with privatization is the corporate liability. There is a possibility that a privatized corporation could be sued or have tort claims arise against them and be liable under a much broader array of scenarios than the FAA is under current law. So it goes on, but just a really good response. But one of the important points to bring out here is that even though this issue is essentially deferred because of the continuing resolution for, what, Maxie, 6 months, I think, the issue hasn't gone away, and it will come back.
No, and it won't go away for a long, long time. I think there are powerful forces that are going to continue to hack away at this. In fact, they've been working on it for probably 25 years easily, so they're not going to give up this year if it doesn't pass.
All right, we need to wrap this one up. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest was John McGinnis. He's the founder and CEO of Synergy Aircraft. You can find them at synergyaircraft.com. There's a lot of interesting material on their website. I encourage you to go take a look at that. Show notes for this episode, you can go straight to them at airplanegeeks.com/476. Also wanted to mention, don't forget to visit the show notes for episode 474. You can hear the remarks that Brian recorded by Congresswoman Dinatitis by FAA Administrator Michael Huerta, Robert Sumwalt, the NTSB chairman, and also Captain Jim Lovell, the retired test pilot and astronaut. You can find those recordings at airplanegeeks.com/474. All right, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, tomorrow I'll be trick-or-treating. I'm sorry. I won't. I actually can't mention that.
Okay.
But if I could be trick-or-treating, I would be, because they always came back with lots of goodies. But anyway, find me and Scott Spangler anywhere that has Jetwine in the name, or for me, any place that has Flying Magazine in the name.
And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on my blog that I need to write on. You can find me moving between my current apartment and my new apartment. And last but not least, you can probably find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAV Digest.
That's right. And Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, the best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com. And also, just wanted to thank you for mentioning those recordings that I edited from NBAA. I did put a bit of work into doing that, and it's unfortunate we didn't play them on the show. But if people will go to the website and listen to them there, it'll make me very happy and make all the work I put into them very worthwhile. So thank you so much.
Yeah, there's players right there in the website, so it's very easy to listen to. And finally, Max Trescott, how do folks find you?
Well, you can find me every week at the Aviation News Talk podcast. And if you want to check it out on the web, aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top. And if you're interested in general aviation, which is everything but commercial and military, check out the show. We're having a lot of fun there.
Yeah. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn at, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
No, I actually only like the Plain Crazy Down Under guys for the candy and cookies they used to bring when they came to the States. Sorry, guys.
Andy's on mute. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
You know what was really bad is I was trying to beat Max to the punch going, and keep the blue side up. But I was on mute, so I couldn't. But maybe another time.
We don't need you, Rob. I do a perfectly good Rob Mark.
I really like that. I thought that was very well done. You've obviously been practicing. Brian, seriously, I wasn't picking on you. I hope I was. Okay.
No, not at all.
I don't want people writing nasty letters saying that I'm picking on you, because trust me, when I start picking on Brian, it will be very clear.
Oh, but I want them to write in nasty letters that they think that you're picking on me. That's fine.
Okay. Never mind.
Oh, good. I'm going to start writing them right now under a pen name.